video games and video realities. And moving, transitioning from this talk into our next talk, we have a talk by Mark Strand, who is professor in the schools of pharmacy and public health at North Dakota State University in Fargo. Mark's research is in the area of chronic disease epidemiology. He has an MS in cell and developmental biology from the University of Minneapolis and a PhD in health and behavioral science from the University of Colorado. He's been an ASA member for 28 years, so welcome, Mark.
Well, good afternoon. It's late. It's Sunday, and I appreciate you all sticking with the conference here late in the afternoon. Science and technology in disservice of humanity. I have no conflicts of interest with regard to this presentation, and what I'd like to talk about is a bit of the history of the opioid epidemic in the U.S., the OneRx project, which I passed out some information on that we're doing in North Dakota presently, and then also try and reflect on some theological insights regarding how we add value to applications of technology. The pharmaceutical industry has utilized technology to serve humanity in almost miraculous ways. From the design of the smallpox vaccine by Edward Jenner in 1798, to streptomycin for curing tuberculosis in 1949, and then chlorpromazine to treat schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in 1952, hydrochlorothiazide for blood pressure treatment in the 50s, on and on, until 2014, Gilead Sciences' design of the hepatitis C miracle drug Harvoni, which for the first time ever can treat and cure hepatitis C. Pharmaceutical science and technology associated with it have made a phenomenal contribution to improved population health. However, technology is susceptible to compromise when corporate interests predominate. The opioid epidemic we are facing in the U.S. was worsened by corporate interests, resulting in iatrogenic effects and the disservice of humanity, which is the topic of this presentation. So first, I'd like to give you a few definitions. Science, basic research to explain the physical world, and with regard to this talk, it would mean things like being able to prove the addictive nature of opioids. From bench science. Technology is applications of science to design products that humans can use. An example of that would be to design tamper-free opioid formulations. Industry is the creation and sale of products of technology. An example of that would be how the pharmaceutical industry was pushing for profit by increasing opioid sales. And then practice is to apply the best evidence of science and the best tools of technology to care for humans. And an example of that would be pharmacists and medical doctors caring for patients and resisting some of the pressures that were there from the pharmaceutical industry for the sake of profit. A couple of other definitions. Iatrogenic simply means illness created by medical treatment. And so that would be examples of that would be opioid medications to treat pain, but then along with that are side effects, even overdose deaths. And then an opioid is the active ingredient in narcotics, referring to any compound that binds to opioid receptors in your brain, which then results in pain modulation and euphoria. And an epidemic is a disease widely occurring in a population requiring particular attention, frequently considered to be 10% incidence above baseline, whatever that might be. So those are a few definitions to guide our work. So first, the history of the opioid crisis. As I said, there are miracle drugs, like the most recent being Harvoni, which netted $7.6 billion in 2016 alone, which puts lots of pressure on the pharmaceutical industry to produce ever more effective drugs. Enter pain. Every year, an estimated 25.3 million adults, 11.2% in America, experience chronic pain, defined as pain every day for the preceding 3 months, in addition to the millions of post-operative patients requiring acute pain management. This resulted in 2001 when the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations issued pain management standards that instructed hospitals to measure and treat pain as the fifth vital sign. And we can all recognize the Wong-Baker FACES pain rating scale, okay, what is your pain today? And you say, oh, I'm a 8 or a 7. And they were rated on that. The hospitals were. Now, this increased pressure on providers to come up with effective analgesics or pain medications for both humanistic and economic reasons, and thus opened the door for liberalizing opioid prescribing for the pharmaceutical industry. Enter OxyContin, approved in 1995 as an extended-release reformulation of oxycodone, which is a very old drug, back to Germany in 1916, and then was reported as being non-abusable and therefore non-addictive, and we could have no dependence. The manufacturer is reported to have focused its marketing efforts on a statement that they put on the label that said, delayed absorption as provided by OxyContin tablets is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug, is believed to. To accomplish this, that meant that OxyContin then came in large doses, up to 120 milligram doses per tablet, which were then released and absorbed in the body gradually. This movement liberalized opioid prescribing, thus accelerating the epidemic. With liberalization of opioid prescribing, thousands of naive, meaning never having had those medications before, patients were thus exposed to a highly addictive drug, setting off progression to opioid addiction among some. 86% of heroin users reported starting with non-medical use of prescription opioids. So, the causes of this trend. So how did we go from a drug being available for pain control to being marketed like candy? In 1951, Arthur Sackler, and I remember that name, Sackler, began what we now know to be ubiquitous, which is the direct-to-consumer advertising of medications, when he convinced Pfizer to begin selling terramycin, a very cheap antibiotic, which netted in 1952, mind you, $45 million. Prior to 2002, they gave away OxyContin fishing hats, stuffed toys, coffee mugs, along with false advertising about the addictive nature of the drug. Usually when patients are demanding ever higher doses of a drug, it's a sign that it's not working. But with opioids, when treatment failed, rather than look for alternative methods of pain management, doctors were taught to treat this as if they hadn't prescribed enough. However, their patients' quality of life was going down. Doctors were then trained to cite the mantra that this was not addictive because they were being told that by the distributors. So they developed a term called pseudo-addiction and prescribed them more, resulting in pill mills, supposed pain clinics, where patients could seek and receive almost unlimited supplies of prescription opioid medications. This resulted in meteoric sales of OxyContin, netting $45 million in 1996, and in 2010, $3.1 billion of OxyContin sales, which occupied 30% of the painkiller market. But what wasn't being observed until 2010 was the rise in opioid addiction and transition to heroin and overdose deaths. And here's an this is an example of scientists and practitioners' disservice to humanity to ignore these observations or to not pick up on these observations or to dismiss them altogether. In this case, opioid prescriptions are plotted along the x-axis as our independent variable. So opioid prescriptions per 100 persons. Now, mind you, we're talking about 70 out of every 100 persons prescribed an opioid in a given year. 70%, that would be. And then along the y-axis, the dependent variable being heroin abuse, which then has a terrific correlation, and there was a clear chronological trend from prescription opioids to heroin misuse. So here's the sales information. So prescribing increased in response to marketing pressure from the pharmaceutical companies, more satisfied patients, and satisfactory pain management scores in the hospitals. The role of corporate interest came to a head, and you'll see here, you know, sales increased 30% of all patients, of all, you know, 30% per 100 persons or 30 per 100 persons for 95, increasing in this linear fashion up until 2007, which was the point in time when Purdue Pharma, the producer of OxyContin, and its top three executives pleaded guilty to criminal charges that they had misled the FDA, clinicians and patients about the risks of OxyContin addiction and abuse by aggressively marketing the drug to providers and patients as safe. So in 2008, they ended up paying $634.5 million fine to avoid federal prison sentences for its executives. In 2014, the DEA, who controls drugs, rescheduled hydrocodone combination products from Schedule 3, meaning maybe abusable, to Schedule 2, likely abusable. Schedule 1 means it's illicit or illegal drugs. And over the next year, 26 million fewer hydrocodone combination products and prescriptions were written, and 1.1 fewer billion hydrocodone combination products were dispensed. So you'll start to see here, as far back as 2008, we did start to see a decline in volume of prescriptions. Now, you might think, problem solved. Not so fast. So from the 1990s up until the 2007, this is the point of the Purdue Pharma lawsuit. What you'll see is the purple line shows the increase in prescription opioid deaths as a result of prescription medications. In 2007, we began to reduce the volume of prescription opioids, but that was simply replaced by the yellow line, which was transitioning to heroin, which was cheaper and more available than OxyContin. So then we had the heroin epidemic. So all the deaths that we've heard about in the last 10 years, they weren't people necessarily directly overdosing on OxyContin or hydrocodone, but it was individuals who started down the pathway as a result of that. And then in the last 5 or 6 years, what we've seen is fentanyl, carfentanil, and illicit drugs that came in, which have been responsible for, in this case, deaths, so opioid deaths. So this is the three waves that we have seen. And so this is the pattern that we've seen, even in spite of decreasing prescribing. Now, you might say, what was the evidence for the narcotics being safe? Well, this is the basis, the scientific evidence, which was used. In 1980, Jane Porter and Herschel Jick published a letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, which you see before you, which said addiction was rare. Mind you, this was not research. This was an 11-line letter to the editor, which said, "We conclude that despite widespread use of narcotic drugs in hospitals, the development of addiction is rare." As of a couple of weeks ago, I could find that this letter to the editor has been cited no less than 1,167 times in the literature. It has been referred to as an extensive study. It was called a landmark report. It was used to show the exaggerated fear that patients might become addicted to these opiates and that this fear was totally unwarranted. The New England Journal of Medicine has since posted a notice on their journal site saying that this has been revisited, and the authors themselves claim to be mortified that it was ever used in that way. So you can see now disservice. Now, what is the role of science, technology, industry, and practitioners in this? And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I'm not an anti-big pharma. I mean, I tried to make a case for the miraculous contributions to human health that the pharmaceutical industry has and continues to make. It's more of a case study of a failure on our part that I'm trying to get at. So let's go back in time. We've always known opioids are addictive. Opium was discovered by many civilizations as early as the 9th century BC. It was seen as an antidote to the worries of life. They knew it was habit-forming and lethal, but still worth it. By the 1800s, German pharmacist Friedrich Sertuner isolated the sleep-inducing element from the poppy plant and named it morphine for the Greek god Morpheus, the god of sleep and dreams. In 1853, Dr. Alexander Wood in Edinburgh invented the hypodermic needle to inject. So rather than using it as an anal suppository or eating it, you could get the instant effect. In 1898, Bayer produced a form of morphine called diacetylmorphine, which was then named heroin from the German word for heroic, which it made you feel. It was a terrific painkiller. War spread this molecule around the world with no less than 300 wars affected by heroin trade around the world, including the Civil War in the U.S., and of course, most famously, the first and second opium wars in China, when Britain imposed opium trade on China, thus addicting a nation and creating scenes such as this. At the start of the 20th century, pharmacy was a burgeoning science. The Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906 recognized the need for a pharmacopoeia, which meant an official standard. You had to report what was in it, you had to know the active ingredient, and you had to report it to patients. So this was the forerunner of the FDA, starting in 1906. In 1914, the Harrison's Narcotics Act placed a tax on the production, sale, and use of opium, and beginning to restrict its use because of all the evidence, you know, all these things that was seen. And starting as early as 1914, it then became highly restricted, highly regulated, until the 1990s. Now, why was it released more so in the 1990s? Tamper-free formulations were being produced, such as, you know, for the, so on the left, what you'll see is they created formulas that allowed for a slow release. And the argument is, so if you look at, this is basically just an absorption, a pharmacokinetics absorption curve. So the bottom line is your threshold or your minimum therapeutic concentration. This is your plasma concentration after taking in the medication over time. So below this gray line, the drug has no effect. And then here's your ceiling effect, this red line. Above this red line, you start to have side effects. In the case of opioids, respiratory distress, or death. And then the upper red line is toxicity. So what you'll see is an oral, this light doesn't work so well, but the orange one, an oral medication, you take the pill, within an hour it's effective, within 2 hours it's coming down, and within 3 hours it's below the line of effect, it's of no use. So what do? Orange line, take another pill. The argument was addiction was resulting from these rises and falls, and so when it went into this upper zone, it created such euphoria that people developed addiction. So the argument of the tamper-free formulations meant that you would have a slow release of the active ingredient in your stomach through an osmotic process, which resulted in this blue line so that it would be released in a steady state over time and therefore reside perfectly in the therapeutic range with no risk. The green one would be your injectables. So this is the argument for the tamper-free products. However, this sounds great, but guess what? When Opana ER, produced by Endo, which is one of these formulation pills, are swallowed, they work just fine over the period of 12 hours. But what happens if you take a Coke can, cut it in half, add 10 milliliters of water, and use a cigarette lighter and throw that Opana ER into the solution? You would dissolve it, you would draw it up, and inject it. So it's tamper-free when it's used according to the instructions. But within hours of its release, there were people under bridges injecting this so-called tamper-free drug. Only in 2017, the FDA pulled Opana ER off the market, one of many examples which had been promoted as being tamper-free. Now, a little bit about opioid addiction and the role of dopamine. So opioid receptors are widely distributed in the body. They're involved in pain modulation found in the central and the peripheral nervous system. And these are what bind to the endogenous opioid peptides that you have in your body and which then, in a natural way, modulate pain. They also bring pleasure. So things like eating, drinking, sex, music, video games, playing with a robot, these all release neurotransmitters and dopamine that makes you happy. And there's a lot of chemistry that we could talk about to explain that. But basically, substance abuse occurs when your normal endogenous level of satisfaction has these supranormal levels, and there's no ceiling really with opioids. The more you take, the happier you feel. You know, sugar, you're really happy for about 10 minutes, and then just you start to feel sick. With opioids, you feel happy until your lungs shut down. You stop breathing. You die. You overdose because there's no sense of that, you know, with every dose, there's a response, which is an increased satisfaction. Now, this year, I wanted to point out, Judy had a nice article in a special series in the Journal of our Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith on this very issue. So I would refer you to it. Was it December of last year?
December.
Refer you to that issue and read Judy's article, which was really good in putting this into context and also adding in opportunities for treatment for addicted individuals from Christian perspective, but also just from a pharmacological and neurological perspective. So on a global level, 2016, the U.S., even in 2016, after the Purdue lawsuits, we're still at 25% higher than Canada and twice as high as any other country that has a normal healthcare system. that provides healthcare for its people. And if you added in countries across Africa and Asia and India, nobody's prescribing opioids like, you know, in the U.S. So we're still at really high rates, and there's no dissociating it from our corporate structure. Now, Purdue Pharma and Sackler, what do you know? March 26, just a few months ago, Purdue Pharma settled another lawsuit, this time with Oklahoma, in order to, and Arthur Sackler is associated with Purdue Pharma, grandson of the guy who started this direct-to-consumer sales. And they, basically, they were just happy to say, we're pleased to have reached an agreement with Oklahoma that will help those who are battling addiction now and in the future. Brace, you know, keep your antenna up. These lawsuits are going to be coming fast and furious because every state and many counties in America have sued these companies. And like the tobacco settlement 20 years ago, there's going to be an opioid settlement coming. Will those dollars be used in the service of humanity? And that's our challenge. That's our calling. What's that? Oh, your affirmation is time up?
Getting close.
Okay. So are we over the hump? Industry-funded attacks on the CDC? No. So we already have, the CDC has regulated opioid prescribing, and now the pain lobbyists and the pharmaceutical industry are already attacking the CDC guidelines because they don't want to see a reduction in prescribing. So what have I been doing? And I passed out a pen for your use and then a little brochure. So in response to this, I'm working with the Department of Human Services in the state of North Dakota, along with five pharmacy colleagues, in order to design a method by which to prevent the start of opioid misuse among naive patients. So we know about naloxone, and I'm wearing my button to prevent overdose deaths, but we need to prevent new cases in order to reduce the prevalence over time. So if you look at this figure, what we're seeing is under our current program, the blue line, we're going to see just as many opioid overdose deaths up until 2025 as we have now because there's so many addicted individuals. And so we need to reduce incidence by at least 11% in order to start to see the orange or that gray line to see a reduction in opioid overdose deaths. And that's what we're after in the 1RX program. We're fighting to, so what we're doing is using community pharmacy to do it, using an algorithm to screen every patient picking up an opioid in the community pharmacy and then providing services to them. Now, the tool that we created, are we already out of time? The tool that we created is 93.6% of the people who should have medication, should have services, are receiving them. So it's working. So let me just jump to some theological insights. In their goal to create and sell the products of technology, industry pushes for minimal regulation. Science produces the evidence, which government should then use to regulate industry, but government easily caves into the pressure of the lobbyists. So we need to be careful. In terms of anthropology, scientists and engineers who design and use technology are human, which means that they are bearing the imprimatur of God through the Imago Dei, and therefore able to create these drugs and serve humans and do, as I said, miraculous things. But they're also fraught with fallenness and sin, as we all are, and therefore hubris, power, greed are all possibilities. As Christians, we're called to guard authentic science and also authentic theology, and I'm channeling Dick Bube here, who used those words. In terms of implications, back to Judy's paper, alcoholism and addictions are a chronic disease. We need to get beyond the moralistic, accusations that are common, because there's also structural sins in our society, poverty, unemployment, the dislocation that are contributing to a large number of individuals who are dying of despair. Our responsibility is to destigmatize this and provide care for them in an evidence-based manner. We have the hope of the gospel, and we have the power of science and technology in our hands. Let's use it in the service of humanity.
Okay, we have time for a few questions. Supper's coming soon, but you can all talk with Mark afterwards. Yes?
Yeah. Historically, heroin was an expensive drug, and so there was a lot of ancillary problems like burglaries and other things because people couldn't support their habits. But I'm told that now it's among the cheapest.
Yeah.
Why is this so? Isn't it the same manufacturing technology it used to be?
easier, I'm not sure, easier to produce, but just such a large market. You know, it's supply and demand.
It's cheaper than OxyContin. Yeah. And patients, when patients find out that it's cheaper than OxyContin, they buy the heroin on the street.
That's why they're moving to it, because it is cheaper.
Right, and more accessible, yeah.
Well, I don't understand why it's cheaper, because it's still, you know, it's coming from outside the USA, from Afghanistan and
sure.
Other countries.
It's a compact molecule. You don't have to have a whole lot to have a lot of doses.
Yeah. Do you know why it's gotten so cheap?
Supply and demand. I mean, it's just
other questions? Yeah.
So you're one of the few clinicians in the audience. I have lots of personal experiences as working in the company. So I appreciated that you said you're not going to just, you know, do blame big pharma. But I would add, there's multiple levels of responsibility.
Yes.
I've had so many patients complain because they were not prescribed narcotics, and then they just go to the doctor next door. And it's so much quicker and easier just to write the prescription than to spend half an hour counseling the person. And what you didn't mention is, and you know, obviously I don't have this time, but just our understanding of the nature of pain, and the psychological nature of pain, it's not just a physical thing. And that gets completely overwhelmed when you're just giving pills, right? So it's just so much more complex. But so, you know, clinician responsibility, government responsibility, but also individual patient responsibility is not often talked about. You know, people have a choice, can make their own, they need to be making informed decisions. And then, particularly among Christians, which concerns me, is this looking for a quick fix. I mean, you can understand if nobody wants to face their own pain, and nobody, and I'm not saying the theology of sin and suffering is large. I'm not saying we're all called to suffer, but you know, maybe some degree of suffering is necessary, not a bad thing, and that we shouldn't just be running to eliminate any physical pain immediately. So there's just multiple complex issues.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, here.
I really like at the end your summary of what the response of the church should be. I think those can be parallel for mental illness and issues of gender identity and all of these things, is that we need to make the church a more open place for people to be comfortable enough to share their shortcomings and still be, you know. So thank you. That was a great way to end it.
Yeah.
I was not like, I've been involved in the soup kitchen back home in Canada. Do you think they should do it with people who, like, who are already addicted? Like, you know, the ideas of, like, people who overdose, like, multiple times in a weekend?
So we need, right now, the best way to get treatment is to get arrested. The best treatment's in prison. We have a system that does not prioritize treatment of people who are responsible for their problems. And so, and furthermore, we don't have enough behavioral health professionals. It's not an attractive position. So a shortage, workforce shortage, healthcare system that has not taken seriously the needs of those disenfranchised persons. You get treatment, you might get a 7-day behavioral health treatment inpatient, and then you're sent out to what? This is a long-term chronic disease, and that's why the addiction, the overdose deaths are going to linger for 10 or 15 years, because an addicted individual doesn't just go in for treatment and 6 months later they're, you know, an elder or something. They're going to be going through ups and downs and recovery and then, you know, recidivism, and it's a long-term journey. Is that not the case?
Yes,
and so,
yes.
You know, it's just a lot of complex factors, but it needs a society that has the economic, the skill, commitment to provide care for those individuals. Yeah.
So if people take it as it's prescribed, is it addictive then?
Absolutely.
It still is. They tend to keep on needing more in order to relieve the pain.
Yeah, so, and that's, you know, part of the problem, as I alluded to, the use of prescription opioids. According to, you know, you start, how many individuals have had a familiarity with a relative or a friend or somebody who went in for something, maybe they had an injury, a knee surgery or something, and 6 months or 10 months later, the report is they're still struggling, they're still having to deal with it, they're wanting more medication, they didn't go into it. Nobody wants to be addicted to these things, but the addictive nature, the mu alpha receptor in your brain has this, you know, this lack of a ceiling effect, and so it's just so satisfying that it's just really, And that's the, to me, that's the naivety that I was suggesting, where technology, science, all of us were asleep at the switch. We had thousands of years of evidence that these needed to be very carefully managed, and many other, most other countries do.
But not everybody gets paid.
No, there's a, no, not everybody by any means, but there's a proportion who are going to have that risk.
The common line that you hear is, if you're really in pain, you won't get addicted.
Oh, you've, nonsense. You know, the propensity for addiction is a complex set of factors. If a person has experienced trauma in childhood, there's going to be a higher risk. Personal or familial experience with chemical abuse, alcohol, or others is going to increase the risk. And those are some of the factors we put into the algorithm we use for the screening that's allowed us to identify.
Genetic factors, too.
Genetics, yes.
Do you want to address very, very briefly the relative problems with fentanyl and carfentanyl? How much carfentanyl do you need?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. You can spread
no,
it.
No, you go ahead. You're there.
No, it's just nanogram levels of these drugs that will kill an individual. So you have heroin that's laced with these. It's a super satisfying unless they added just a little more than they might have. I'm sure you've heard of police officers or individuals coming into an overdose situation, falling over. I haven't heard of a death, but I've heard of them having to be rescued with naloxone just by touching it with their fingers.
In the Vancouver area, it's been reported that morgue workers have to wear gloves and take prevention against being infected with, coming in contact with fentanyl, because it's such a small dose that can kill you.
I have some personal name cards, and I also have some cards that align with the website about our program. So if anybody wants either of these, you can come and grab one after we're done. Thank you for staying late, on the Sunday afternoon.
Now we can meet our addiction to food.
thanks, Judy. Thank you so much.